So you ever feel like you're too late for something that, like, you know, the train has already left the station and you're not on that train?
Totally. And I mean, you and I have accomplished a lot and we still feel like that every single day.
And so many people feel like it's too late for me, or I don't have the capabilities, or I don't have the experience, or I don't have the money to do so. And then you meet someone like our next guest, Fran Weisler, who is the queen of Broadway.
Right. But started in her 50s.
In her 50s.
Yeah.
And the previous 16 years, using a station wagon and a U-Haul, she was touring America and doing plays at high schools. And then she turns 50 and somehow convinces James Earl Jones to star in Othello, ends up winning a Tony for it, and goes on to
She has no money, no experience. She has no business
doing this.
Doesn't
have a venue to do it.
No
venue. She convinces James Earl Jones to star in one of her plays, her first Broadway play, and she then creates this career starting at 50 for the next 45 years. She's 95 now and becomes the queen of Broadway. She now has 7 Tonys, has produced over 20 Broadway shows, and she's still going. And she's a shining example that, like, it's never too late. If you're ambitious and you're thoughtful and you're hardworking and you put it all on the line, then you can be a big shot at any age.
And she's able to find some of the biggest names in movies and in TV and get them, like Kathleen Turner, and get them to come into Broadway. And the story she tells about how she does this, such chutzpah. She really didn't have much of a reputation. She had no reputation.
Yep.
And she somehow, step by step by step, creates these incredible plays.
Right.
And then that story about how once she's incredibly successful, she takes it all and puts it all on the
line.
Which
she doesn't
have
to do.
Chips in
the
middle.
She decides basically to put it all on the line again.
For that one play.
Her journey about, you know, encountering sexism and chauvinism and having to deal with financial companies who don't want to back her, and artists and their drama.
Right.
And, like, she tells these stories about all these crazy celebrities who she brings in who have all these crazy writers and these crazy restrictions and needs. But she finds a way to build this incredible company, and she will go down as being one of the
most
iconic, legendary people in theater in the whole world.
She has so much grace. She persevered. She's elegant. Her stories are fabulous. You're gonna
Ladies
love
and
Fran
gentlemen,
Weisler.
Fran Weisler. Started from the bottom, now the whole team here. Started from the bottom, now we here. Started from the bottom, now my whole team in. Started from the bottom, now we here. Started from the bottom, now the whole team. Yeah, I done kept it real from the jump. So first of all, Fran, we are so honored you're here, but let me just read something to you and ask a question. You've produced 19 plays on Broadway. You've won 7 Tonys. People call you the queen of Broadway, but I want to go way back to your childhood, and I'm curious what it was like growing up in your household, your parents, the dinner table, Shabbos dinners. What was that like?
I think we produced 34 Broadway
shows. Okay. So I'm off by like half.
But I think, just so you know.
Subtle flex.
But then you,
subtle flex.
But then you can count it.
Oh, later. I liked it. I
was growing up, I was born in Utica, New York. And then we moved to Syracuse, New York. And my father was in the shoe business, and my mother was a housewife. I was never, unfortunately, close to my mother. She was a tough lady, and I didn't relate to her as well as I wish I had. But I was very, very close to my father.
Did your mother ever see your success? Was she around for that?
She didn't. But my greatest regret is that he didn't. I mean, he saw the very beginning when we produced Babes in Toyland, which was like our first. We weren't on Broadway, we were in the theater off Broadway, a large theater, which I can't remember. He never, ever saw, and I sometimes think of that and it still saddens me and makes me crazy, because he would have so loved it, so loved it.
Was there art in your house? Was that type of theater, that type of art and music part of your childhood?
Nothing. Truly, no. I mean, it was all very pleasant, and we went to the movies, and we bought clothes, and I was always a foodie, and I continue to be. Next to theater, my love is food. So
was that part of your upbringing? Good food in the house?
No, I don't think my mother was a good cook. So maybe that was part of it without my really understanding that. But anyway, I grew up and we were not rich, we were not poor, very middle class. And
was there a lot of Jews where in your community?
Probably, but I was not aware of it. I mean, I was aware of it, but not aware of it. Right. If you understand. Yeah. Anyway, I lived with them, and then I went to New York University, where I studied dramatic art and majored in English and minored in dramatic art. And so I speak reasonably well. And I always loved theater, but never thought I would be involved in it. I just loved it, and I loved going.
Right. Do you remember the first play, the first piece of theater you drew?
I think it was called Claudia, which I can't remember enough about it, honey, but it was about a woman in her life and sort of a drama comedy. And
where did you see it?
I saw it on Broadway.
On Broadway.
And I don't know how I did or...
Yeah, who brought you? Yeah. But it hit you.
And I was in Boston, and why was I at the theater? I wish I could be better at this, but it is what it is.
Yeah.
So, and then I married a man from Boston, and he was 6'2" and blue-eyed, and when he walked into a room, everybody turned and looked at him. He was that attractive, and I kind of fell asleep while he was talking. So
he was boring?
He was boring.
Good-looking but boring.
Yeah, good-looking. A lot of guys use their looks, and underneath, you keep scraping and scraping. There's not too much.
I mean, David and I have to have big personalities because we don't have the looks.
So you're okay. Yeah, you're okay. Yeah. You made it.
Yeah, we tried.
But he was a lovely, lovely man and loved me and was very good to me. And I had two children with him. And leaving him was very, very hard because, as I said, he loved me and was in love with me. I loved him, but was not in love with him. And I had two children. So I had to make a huge decision. And I had no real money. I wasn't poor, but I had no money. So it was, what do I do, you know, with the rest of my life? But I knew that to be in a marriage that was sort of like this.
Like mediocre.
Yeah.
Yeah, just, you don't strike me as someone that does anything halfway.
No, you're very wise. Yeah. I wish I did.
Although
I'm very calm. I'm extremely calm.
How did you know? I mean, you had a fairly comfortable life. I'm sure, like, was it a lack of inspiration? Like, how did you know that this major decision in your life was the right one?
I think no matter how great the sex or how great the attraction, of which there was certainly one, ultimately, it's about being intellectually on the same level. It's really, really important that you can talk to each other and that you respect what each other says. And if something happens and you can't wait to tell him or her, or him and him, whoever it happens to be, and say, I have to tell you this, I can't wait. I never wanted to say that to him. Not that he was stupid or anything, but he just wasn't endlessly interesting. So leaving him with two children was hard, really hard, but I made a decision that I didn't want the rest of my life to be like this.
Yeah, flat.
It shouldn't be too much like this, but it's better than being like this. So I did leave, and it was very, very hard to do that to my children and to him.
Around 1970, you formed the National Artist Management Company.
That was the one with Barry.
Yeah, so how did that all happen? How'd you meet Barry? How'd you form that company? What was that all about?
A friend of mine wanted me, I lived in New Jersey by then. I didn't live in New York. And there was a theater called Theater on the Green. And a friend of mine was the box office person. And she called me, it was a Sunday. And she said, I'm really sick, I have the flu. Can you please take over? I said, no, I can't add and subtract. I love you, but I can't give change. Today, you don't have to worry. They have
it's all computerized, yeah. Right.
But then, and I practically flunked math. I was great at English, but I couldn't add or subtract. I could never multiply. So she said, what are you talking about? I said, I'm telling you, I can't give change. It'll be really hard. She said, okay. She calls me back an hour later. And says, Fran, I called everyone. It's a Sunday afternoon. Everyone's busy but you.
She must have been a good friend.
Yeah. It was good enough.
Or very persuasive.
Do you know, she said, you've got to do it. You know, if she had found someone, I wouldn't have met Barry.
Wow.
I know.
It's serendipitous.
So you agreed to be the box office lady
on
Theater on the Green.
Yeah.
And at this point, you like theater, but it's not. You're not thinking of being in the theater business.
No.
Right.
It's
far from it.
Yeah. Oh, no. I didn't even connect that.
Sure. Right.
So now I go, and the show that they had at Theater at the Green, Barry was in as an actor, which he was awful. And then he was the director and he was the producer. So everything he was doing. And at the
it was kind of his production.
It was his production.
Okay.
And totally mediocre.
Okay.
And
I'm sure you remind him of that all the time.
You know, I forgot to when I go home later.
You tell him that, yeah.
So now he's there and he's doing all this stuff. And I met him. And there was no attraction at the beginning. When I met him, I was 35, he was 26. And he continues to be 11 years younger than me.
Still to this day, 11 years younger.
And it works. Yeah. It works. It's the best thing, smartest
Amazing.
Thing I ever did. So he was there and we met. And there wasn't any attraction. There was just a mutuality of interests. And he said, you know, I'm working and I want to form a company. I want to do things. And I think I need some help. And would you, by that time I was getting divorced. I had nothing to do. And it was like, this might be like a lifeboat?
Yeah.
A life raft.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I said, yeah, maybe I will do that. And that's how it began. So we were going to form this company, the National Artist Management Company.
Why'd you call it that? What was it?
I don't have no. It's so desperately dull, isn't it? I know.
Sounds actually like now it seems very prestigious.
Yeah, it does.
Whole country though.
I know.
The whole country.
But you know what struck me before even you founded that was that both you and Barry, I believe, were in retail at a certain point in your life, right?
Yeah, he was. Yes, his father owned a retail store.
Okay, you did not work in retail.
My father was in the shoe business, which is retail.
Yes.
But I never worked in retail.
But retail in many ways, I mean, I worked in retail my whole life, so has Harley. And in many ways, it's theater. Was there anything you picked up from your dad around selling, around his business, of how he went about putting on a display around shoes to get people to buy them? Like, did that connect dots for you at all?
Not for one second.
Not for one second, yeah.
It never entered my mind.
Yeah.
But I adored him, and he had leased departments, shoe departments, and department stores. He didn't own a shoe store.
He had sort of a space in a store within a store.
Yeah. Right. So in Lord & Taylor's,
there's
a shoe department. Yeah. Or in Saks, there's a shoe department.
Wow.
So he leased those. That's what he did. And he made a good living, not great, but and not bad.
Yeah.
But a medium, we lived a very nice life.
Did your father-
Not rich, but not poor.
Okay, so you meet Barry, and so you have the National Arts, what is it, National-
National Artist Management Company.
Right.
Very good.
I believe you go to your dad and you're like, I really like this guy. He's got no money and he has no idea what he's doing.
Yeah, and I have no idea what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I had two kids.
Right.
Right. So, from a previous marriage.
From a previous marriage. Yeah. So.
But your father, to his credit, I believe, said, go with your heart.
He did.
And that's a wonderful
thing. He did. I said, what should I do? I think I like this guy. I'm not in love with him, but I think I like him and I like what he does. And it's kind of interesting to me. And he said to me exactly that, go with your heart. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. You're young, you'll start all over again. But you gotta try things.
Wow.
You have to take a shot. And, you know, so, you know, I did. And we weren't romantic for, not a long time, 6 months mm-hmm. maybe, mm-hmm. not 6 years,
yeah.
When we fell in love with each other. But before that, it was strictly business.
So you were business partners first.
Yes.
When you met, it was like, he wants to do this thing, you're gonna join for the ride, but it was all about the business, not about the love.
So we met and he wanted to produce shows on Broadway. As I said, we had no money and much worse, we didn't know anything.
Right.
We didn't even know
what you didn't know.
What we didn't know.
Yes. But what ambition, though? I mean, to say we want to produce shows on Broadway.
Yeah, but we knew. So
you had a dream.
We said, so what should we do? How do we make a living? And I remember that a group of players came to my school, and I said, Barry, we can't go to Broadway, but we can play schools like high schools. We can produce theater. We found out that in America, you can't charge students during school hours.
You're not allowed.
This is a democracy. Education is free. So now I'm like out of my mind. And I called my best friend who happened to be Catholic, and I said, I think I'm in love with this guy, and I have two kids from a previous marriage, and I think we're going to starve, and I don't know what to do, and I don't know what to do with the rest of my life. She said, stop talking. You can play the Catholic schools. They're a private institution.
You can charge
and
them.
And they'll charge during school hours. And especially if you do what's required reading. And I said, oh my God, that would be fantastic. So.
Praise Jesus.
For the next 16 years, not two, 16 years, we played the Catholic schools.
Wow.
And we did Shakespeare, Sophocles, George Bernard Shaw, whatever was required reading. We had symposiums at the termination of the show whereby the actors could relate to the students. 6 months in advance, we sent study guides. We were really business oriented, thank God. And so they had study guides so that they knew what we were going to do when we got there. And we had a station wagon attached to it was a U-Haul. The U-Haul had the sets, costume, props. The actors were in the station wagon. And we went from school to school to school. 16 years.
Wow, talk about, you
16
know,
pay
slow,
your dues.
I mean, you paid your dues, but also, I mean, it's a grind. I mean, high schools are not exactly glamorous. The places they're in are not glamorous.
Oh,
you're
no.
not in Los Angeles or New York City. Oh, I mean, you're in small town America.
Yeah.
What did that teach you about the theater business?
I don't know how much it taught us. It was like, I can't explain it. It was a job. And we liked it. We really liked it. We didn't love it.
Mm-hmm.
But we were still producing theater, which we loved to do. And we were casting it, and we were having auditions. We were doing all that. But we had our eye way up here. Mm-hmm. And for 16, it's a long time.
Yeah, 16 years is a long time.
It isn't like five or six.
Yeah.
But we did that. And
well, because now you're probably 50 years old, and you're still doing it at this point.
I think I started really going into the real business when I was like 50.
Yeah, wow.
What did I say, I'm 95 now? Yeah. So, I must have been 50.
Wow.
So, oh, God.
What a life.
Yeah. I know, what a life.
So how did you
And we loved each other.
And so you loved each other.
Like, oh, God, thank God.
Well, spending that many years on the road with
yeah.
someone you're not really in love
yeah.
with might be
yeah,
challenging.
Yeah.
How was it in terms of your children? I mean, that must have been difficult because you're away from them, I suspect.
No, you know, I was very careful to be home every night for dinner.
Wow.
Every night, and made sure that the four of us ate together.
Wow.
That was really important to me. As I said, I'm a foodie.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't only the food, it was the camaraderie. It was knowing there was a family. It was really important to me. And especially since I was divorced,
mm-hmm.
I felt I owed my children that.
So you would drive back. You'd be driving all around, but
yeah,
day trips.
Yeah, but
so that you could get back for dinner with your kids.
Yes, yes. I mean, we really did. I mean, maybe once in a while we couldn't, but basically we did that. You can't, in my opinion, fail or try, or afford to when your children are home. So now they're fine. So we can afford to take a shot. So we took a shot, and we produced our first Broadway show, which of course was Shakespeare.
Yeah.
That's all the hell we knew.
Sure.
And it was Othello.
Because that was what you were putting on for the Catholic schools.
When we did Othello during part of that 16
right.
years. But we knew Othello is the most accessible of Shakespeare's shows. It's very understandable.
Mm-hmm.
And. So we produced Othello.
And how do you do that? I mean, how do you take a show? You've been producing Othello for the Catholic schools. You and Barry decide, let's go to Broadway. How does that happen? How do you go to Broadway?
The way we could go to Broadway is we had two actors that sold tickets. We couldn't just do Othello. We had to do Othello with someone playing Othello and someone playing Iago opposite him. Othello was James Earl Jones. Iago was Chris Plummer.
Wow.
So how do you get them though? I mean, at this point, you guys.
And we didn't know anything and right. We didn't know anybody. We had Jimmy because.
James Earl Jones.
James Earl Jones.
With that voice, that incredible voice, right?
Oh, God.
I mean, unbelievable.
So I had never met him. I knew his manager, agent, whose name was Lucy Kroll, and I loved her. And for some reason, she latched onto me also, even though I was nobody. She was very kind to me. And Jimmy was doing a show, and I can't remember the details, I apologize, but something happened to the show. It was a one-man show whereby the person that was directing it said that he didn't believe in the show they were doing and they were going to strike. All his friends were going to strike the show that Jimmy was performing, this one-man show. And she called me and said, James Earl Jones is not going to perform where they're striking in front of the theater. He can't handle it, yeah. He can't do it, and he can't handle
it. Not good for his
Chris brain. Could yeah. handle it, but yeah. Jimmy could. So she said, so I just want you to know he's available because the show isn't happening.
But he's a well-known.
Oh, he's James Earl
Jones.
Yeah,
he's James Earl Jones.
Even then he was James Earl
Jones. Right,
Jones.
Even then he was, and at this point you've never produced a play on Broadway.
Never.
It's like going from about the minor leagues all the way to the All-Star game.
Yeah. But all I knew is that he was available. I didn't know what to do with him. And Barry didn't. We just thought, James Earl Jones, James Earl Jones.
What do we do?
What do we do? Yeah. Right. What do we do? And then this friend of ours had two tickets to the Stratford Festival in Stratford, Connecticut to see a show that featured Christopher Plummer. And they were free, and we had no money, so we went. Anything free, we went. So he said, somebody's sick, and would you like the tickets? We said, yes. So we go, and we see the first act. I don't remember the name of the show, honey, but whatever it was, it was Shakespeare. And we'd look at each other at intermission and say, we've got James Earl Jones, and look how great Christopher Plummer is. Maybe we could do Othello with James Earl Jones, who we have, and maybe we can get Chris. And he says, oh my God, maybe we can do that. So we wait till the curtain comes down. We run to the dressing room and Barry says, I don't think we both should go in to meet Chris. Chris Plummer was like, I never even met James Earl Jones, even though we had him, I never met him. He said, I don't think we both should go in. I think it'd be overwhelming. I said, okay. He said, and I don't think a man should go in. I think you should go in and talk to Chris Plummer. I said, oh my God, how can I do it? What am I gonna? He said, honey, just the worst that happens is we don't get him.
He says no.
I mean, other nothing than committing suicide, you know, we'll be fine.
Yeah.
I said, okay. So the curtain comes down, I run, I knock on the door, and the door opens, and the dresser answers. The dresser thinks they're the actor. She says, yes. And I said, my name is Fran Weisler. I'd like to see Christopher Plummer, if you don't mind. She said, are you stupid? She had no idea who I was. I was nobody, but she didn't know. She said, the curtain just came down. He's in full makeup. He's in full costume. You came the minute the curtain came down. He can't see you now. I said, I'm so sorry. I didn't understand that. I'll wait. She said, please wait. So she slammed the door. So now I wait. And I'm sitting there with Barry, even though I'm going in alone, and everybody comes out, the production stage manager, the carpenters, the electricians, the lighting designers, the actors, 30 minutes. And we're sitting there thinking, for 16 years, we produced theater in schools, Catholic schools, we're Jews in Catholic schools. And we said, we have a shot on Broadway, and we're sitting here, and our heart is, it was like our whole future was in that stupid meeting. So now the door opens and she says, you can see him now. And I'm thinking, please God, let her leave the room. She leaves.
Okay.
So he's sitting there.
So it's just you and Chris.
Just Christopher only, like, what's the smoking jacket, the cravat, the black velvet shoes with the gold crest. The legs are crossed.
Right out of a movie, yeah.
It's Christopher Plummer. He's stunning and he's smart. I thought, I'm going to have a heart attack, but I'll do it. So he said, yes. And I said, my name is Fran Weischler, and I have James Earl Jones. And we also secured the Winter Garden Theater because of your name and James Earl Jones's name. So if the two of you would, if you would consider starring in Othello opposite Mr. Jones, we would like to produce it. And I would be very excited if you could do that. I don't know what I just talked. Yeah. And there's a long pause. And he says, what did you say your name was again? And I said, Fran Weischler. He said, Mrs. Weischler, a producer, a professional producer, doesn't barge into an actor's dressing room and ask the actor to do a show. Do you understand? I said, yes. He said, a professional producer calls the actor's agent or manager and talks to them about securing the actor. Do you understand? I said, I understand. He said, my agent is Lou Pitt, P-I-T-T. He works at ICM, International Creative Management. It's in Los Angeles. And there's a 3-hour time. I said, I know that part. I know there's a 3-hour time difference. So he said, I suggest you call my agent. Okay. I said, thank you so much. I'm so sorry. And do you know, I remember, honest to God, to this day, I was so paralyzed. I couldn't turn around. I walked out backwards. And then I felt for the knob. I go out the door, Barry's there. He says, so, what happened? I said, we have to call Lou Pitt, his agent. Barry said, oh, I can do that. I said, yeah, you can do that after I
You did all the heavy lifting.
Mr. Big Shot.
Now Barry, yeah, Barry's Mr. Big Shot now, right.
But hold on, I gotta know. So it's one thing to be able to walk into a room and say, we have James Earl Jones. But James Earl Jones, I mean, when he agreed to do Othello, you had no money, no theater, no. You had an idea, you call him up. I mean, he wasn't just bored. I mean, what was it about you and Barry that and the proposition that you gave him that made him say yes?
I mean, it's a lot of chutzpah there, right? I mean, that is the definition of chutzpah.
How did you get him to say yes?
Well, first, I didn't do it. You know, he told me I had to call the agent. So it is true. There's a 3-hour time difference. So we woke up at 5 the next morning. You have to remember, for 16 years, all we did was play the Catholic school. Now we have maybe James Earl Jones, Christopher Plummer, Othello, the Winter Garden Theater based on their names, and our first Broadway show with these two extraordinary...
Oh, wait, so it's a maybe. So James Earl Jones is not 100%.
He's 100%.
He is 100%.
But Chris...
Yeah. Chris, yeah. And so the theater's maybe, too.
The theater on the two of them.
On the two of them, okay.
Nothing to do with
us.
Right. So now we had to call Lou Pitt. There is a 3-hour time difference. So we're up at 5 because we can't sleep. We're like crazy. And
which is 2 o'clock in the morning in LA.
Oh God, it was so. So now 12 noon we call. It's 9 o'clock, and we say, "This is Barry and Fran Weischler. May we speak to Mr. Pitt?" She says, "Mr. Pitt never comes in before 10, which of course in Los Angeles.
Right.
Who comes in at 9?
He was out the night before.
Yeah, I mean, nobody comes in at 9 in LA. Here, yes, here 8. Mm-hmm. So now we said, okay. So now it's 2 o'clock. We're up since 5. We're such a wreck. We call. Oh, we're so sorry. She was so lovely. Mr. Pitt had a dentist appointment, and he'll be in an hour and a half. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to mislead you. So now it's like 3:15. So if I tell you that we couldn't even talk to each other. We were too. It was our whole new life dependent upon this phone call. So now, okay, we finally call. Yes, this is Lou Pitt. We said, oh, this is Fran and Barry Weischer. We wanted to ask you. He said, you don't have to say anything. I spoke to Mr. Plummer last night. You know, there's a 3-hour time.
Enough with the time difference.
We said yes. And he said, and Mr. Plummer would be delighted to play Iago opposite Mr. Jones's Othello. Do you know we couldn't speak? And so in a second, there was, hello, hello? we couldn't. We said, we're here, we're here. He said, okay, you're here? I said, yeah. Barry said, yeah. He said, okay, take a deep breath. I said, thank you, thank you. He said, so what's the deal? And we said,
what do you mean?
We have to make it.
You're in now.
We have to pay. Who knew we had to pay?
I mean, he's a professional actor, you know.
We didn't. So Barry was so much smarter than me. He said, you know, we didn't discuss the deal because we didn't want to make ourselves crazy if you said no. So we'll call you tomorrow morning. He said, you will call me no later than 12 noon my time or there's no deal. Do you get it? Because we were nobody then, sure. And he treated us like nobody.
He pushed you around. Yeah.
Do you get it? We said, we get it. The great thing about our industry, as you know, is everybody is nice to each other, whether it's TV, film, or theater. Yeah. People help each other. Yeah. So we called three different, very important people and said, we have James Jr., we have Christopher Plummer. What do we pay them? And they all were within like $10 of each other. So we knew exactly
what to pay.
What to pay them and what to do. Yeah.
So now you have a great Iago. And you have James Earl
Jones.
Oh
my God, I have.
And you have Chris. You have James or Jimmy.
And a theater.
Jimmy. And you have a theater.
Winter theater.
And it's your first Broadway.
And we win the Tony.
And you won a Tony.
I know.
But wait, you have no money.
But if you have, James Earl Jones and Christopher Plummer,
you get the money. Yeah.
So your first show ever on Broadway. These two great people, great theater. You win a Tony. What's that like for you? Yeah. And Barry,
can you imagine?
No, I can't.
So Alec Cohen, who was in charge of the Tonys then, put us in the second to the last row in the theater, knowing...
What are the chances? Yeah.
He didn't know us, but it was stupid because of the name value of our stars. Yeah. But he did it. I'm very awkward. So Barry, when we won, coming all the way down the aisle, Barry saying, don't fall, don't fall, don't fall. Don't fall. He never stopped saying it because I've always been awkward and I continue to be. So now we win the Tony.
What was that like? You're on stage with your husband, who you're in love with. Your first Broadway show. You're holding a Tony Award. What is that like for you?
We were so beside ourselves, and we look out and we see all these sea of producers and directors and
important
actors
people.
Who actually look at us. We spent all those years looking at them, and remember. When I started doing well, I was 50,
right.
And 52, 53. 50. I wasn't 20, 30, 40. Mm-hmm. I was in my 50s.
Why were you such a great producer? I mean, it's not luck. I mean, yes, you had James Earl Jones and Christopher Plummer, but like you were able to take this play and make magic out of it.
I think we had a talent for it and we're very good together, Barry and me. We're very different. Our personalities are very different. But we care deeply about each other. Therefore, we care about each other's opinions. Mm-hmm. So we listen to each other. And what he lacks, I have, and vice versa. Yeah. And he's the business part of it. I'm much more the artistic part, although he's also artistic. Mm-hmm. But I'm not business, at all.
So now you have this Tony, and now you have this some momentum. But then you had another hit, which was Madea.
Madea.
Tell us about that one.
I remember it was with Zoe Caldwell. And when we were doing Othello, Peter Coe was the director. And we were rehearsing it in New Jersey in a theater there before it came to Broadway. And one day I walked into the theater and I was so terrified. I mean, I had these two actors and my first Broadway show and I didn't have confidence. And I was like a wreck and excited, an excited wreck. So I walk into the theater and I'm in the middle and I see James Earl Jones is sitting on like a puffy cushion and he's like this. And Christopher is doing he's a great swordsman. So he's doing his thing and loving himself, which he did, but I loved him. So he's doing his sword thing. And Peter Coe, who's the director, is looking at Mr. Jones, who's looking like this, and he's saying, Mr. Jones, your problem isn't the direction I'm giving him. Obviously, he questioned the direction. He said, your problem is that Mr. plumber is mapping up the floor with you.
Ooh, wow.
So there are the directors who know that in the show, if there are two people who don't like each other or who don't get along together and clash, it might be good to do that in real life. Mm-hmm. So they can bring that real life animosity to the theater.
Wow.
I've never
create a real conflict.
Yeah, real conflict.
Oh yeah, I never felt that. I felt you're an actor. You love each other. You're supposed to hate each other. Act.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Come on.
Yeah, you're professional.
So,
yeah.
So he's saying that to him, and Jimmy's got his head down, and Christopher's doing his thing, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I think I'm the producer of this show, which.
You didn't know you were the producer.
I said, I can't let Jimmy sitting with like this. I'll get a phone call from Lucy telling me he quit or something.
Right.
So I walked down and I said, Mr. Coe, I'm Fran Weiser. I don't think you mean that. I mean, you know, you're talking to two great actors, and I'm sure that you didn't really mean that Mr. Plumber is mopping up the floor with. And he said, and Mrs. Weisler, how many Broadway shows have you produced? I said, this is my first one. He said, that's right, this is your first show. Do you understand? I know that and you know that. I said, yes, I understand you know that. He said, so, Mr. Jones, your problem isn't the line reading that I gave you. Your problem, and I'm repeating myself, is that Mr. Plummer is mopping up the floor with you. And James just kept looking there. And all of a sudden, I guess in that moment, maybe, I don't know, I've never said it like this, maybe I became a producer. I looked at him and I said, Mr. Coe, please don't say that anymore. We have a great show. We have two incredible actors. I mean, you're so lucky. I'm so lucky to be producing it. You're lucky to be directing it. Let's just move forward. What good does this do? And he said again, how many shows have you produced? I said again, this is my first show. He said, that's right. And something like clicked and I said, Mr. Coe, this may be my very first Broadway show as a producer. But I know one thing a producer can do that a director cannot. A producer can fire a director, and you're fired. That really happened.
In front of the two actors.
In front of everybody.
Yeah.
Whoever was sitting.
Wow.
And I said it, and then I thought, now I faint. Because I couldn't believe. And you know something? With all due respect to him, he didn't say a word.
He walked out.
He walked out, he got his stuff together, and he walked out.
Wow. What did Barry say when you're like, I just fired our director?
No, Barry was in New York in the office. So now, Christopher now drops the sword, and James quietly looks up. And they're both staring at me, and I'm thinking, oh shit, what do I do?
What do?
I said, don't worry. Take the rest of the day off, relax, go to your dressing rooms, go to your homes. We'll be here tomorrow and everything will get explained and done. And please don't worry about a thing. And they just couldn't leave.
They couldn't believe it.
They stood there and kept looking at me.
Yeah.
And I couldn't.
Sure.
So anyway, they left. I'm alone in the auditorium and I turn around and I look at all these seats. And I'm
thinking, all empty at this point because
there's
right,
nobody
there's
there.
No one there.
And I'm thinking, what the hell did I just do? But I knew in my gut it was right. I knew you can't treat an actor like
yep.
James. I knew. So I said, okay, Fran, get your act together. Go. I went to the office. I called Barry and he said, so how are things?
What'd you say?
I said, do you mind coming? I have things I have to tell you. And he said, Fran, I don't know. I said, just come. You have to come. It's really important. He said, can you tell me on the phone? I said, I don't think so. So he said, so come. So he came, and of course I told him. And that night, Chris was in another show because they performed in Repertory, all those theaters, and Stratford. There's a Stratford in London, in Canada, and in Connecticut. So we watched the first act, and Barry said, "I don't know what, you know, I don't know what we're going to do. This is just," I said, "I don't know either. I don't know either." So at the end of the show, we went into the dressing room, and the dressing room was filled with well-wishers and people that loved Christopher. And one of them was Zoe Caldwell with her husband, who at that time was a great producer. His name was Robert Whitehead. And if you ever look him up, he was a gentleman, a white-haired, good-looking, semi-older guy. And Zoe Caldwell was, wow! Mm-hmm. I mean, she was a great actress. And anyway, I had an idea seeing them in the dressing room. I don't know where it came from, but they go to leave, and I said to Barry, "I'm just going to follow them. Give me 1 minute." I follow them out, and I said, "Would it be okay, Ms. Caldwell and Mr. White, if I called you in the morning? I just have to ask you something really important," which just, I don't know why, but it fermented in my mind. And she said, "Who are you?" I said, "My name is Fran Weiss." She said, "So?" I said, I'm going to produce the show with my husband, and if I could just, she said, "Why would I give you my phone number? I have no idea who you are, in spite of what you just said. I'm not giving out my phone number." And Robert Whitehead said this, and I'll never forget, because he said, this very slim girl, I was very thin then, and I'll always remember him saying, this very slim girl came running out and asked us to call, and we're going to say no to her. She followed us out. He said, "Here's my phone number."
Wow.
He was such a, he was so fabulous. So now I wait and wait and wait. And I had this idea because I knew Christopher was very close to Zoe and Robert. So the next morning, I have the number, I call. And she said, "This is Zoe. What do you want?" Mrs. Weiss said, "What do you want?" I said, "I want an incredible favor for you." She said, "Tell me what it is." I said, "I want you to direct the rest of the show." She said, "I'm an actress. I'm not a director. I don't know about blocking. I don't know about costumes. I don't know about sets." I said, "You don't have to know that. We have the blocking. It's all done," which is where they go.
Yeah.
"We have the sets. We have the costumes. We have the lighting. I just need someone to work with Jimmy and Chris and the rest of the actors." And since he was in her dressing room, and both James and Chris have to have a say on who directs, they can say yes or no to a producer, because they're such big stars.
And you knew they had a connection too.
She's in the dressing room with them. I knew, and I knew James would say yes to anything. He was so easy, but Chris was not easy. So she said, why would I direct the show? I said, "You don't have to do anything, just direct it. They have such respect for you. And will you just think about it?" She said, "All right, call me back in a week." I said, "I have to call you back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. She said, "Call me in a week." I said, "I have to call you back tomorrow." The next morning, I call. And she says, "I didn't sleep all night because my husband kept me up. And I'm going to direct," I'm going to quote her, "your fucking show." That's exactly what she said. "I'm going to do it, but I want something in return." I said, "Anything. What do you want?" She said, "All my life I wanted to play Medea. Will you produce it?" I said, "I will produce it and you can play it."
Wow, what a story.
So she said, "Okay, after I direct this, do you give me your word?" I said, "I give you my word." She said, "Do you have to talk to Barry?" I said, "I'll tell him, he'll understand." She directed the show.
Wow.
And they listened to her. The show was such a hit. It ran for a year and a half, or however long you can do Shakespeare. And we won our first Tony.
Wow.
And she directed it. Then she starred the same year in Medea.
Which you produced as
which
well.
Which I produced, and she won the Tony.
Amazing.
So nobody ever heard of us. So we won.
So now basically, you're two for two at this
I
point.
I know it. And she says, "And I thank you, Fran and Barry Weiss." So they heard our name twice.
It's a hell of a rookie season.
That was the beginning of our...
So I have to say, there's like this theme that's kind of emerges here, Fran, which is when you, first of all, frankly, leaving a husband that you loved but weren't in love with, taking a chance with Barry to go, effectively go to these Catholic schools, getting someone like James Earl Jones and Chris to be in the show, dealing with this whole Madea thing and firing the director, which frankly you kind of had no business doing, but you felt it was the right thing to do. There is a sense of trusting your gut, a sense of I will figure it out. Where does that come from? How did you develop that?
From being 50. I think if I had been 22 mm-hmm. or 32, I had more confidence in myself. I had lived longer. I had seen more. That's the only thing I can think of. I can't give myself credit that I had great foresight
right.
or talent.
But you didn't have some chutzpah.
Well, I had chutzpah.
And that chutzpah,
did you ever?
That's something that we think a lot about, which is that, you know, a lot of, a disproportionate amount of Jews and people, Jews from very humble beginnings, have sort of this chutzpah and you embody that and often it's because...
They need it because they're always down here. So they need that kind of chutzpah.
Explain that a little bit to us. We think a lot about that. What do you mean by they're always down here?
Well, Jews have always been... they're not Christians, which rules the universe. And there has always been some anti-Semitism, times when it's here, times when it's not. Now, slowly, it's scaring me a little bit.
Me too.
But... I don't know, I think in order to counter that, you work twice as hard because you think it's not going to be as easy to get there being a Jew as being Christian.
Yeah.
So and you don't know you're doing it, you don't say it out loud like I'm doing now. It just sort of happens.
You kind of have no choice.
It was chutzpah,
yeah.
But it was also this situational creativity. And this comes across time and time again in your career. Whether it's the Kathleen Turner story, which I'm sure we'll get into, but it's you cast people in unusual roles. I mean, here you took someone who had never directed anything and put her in a director's situation, and you win a Tony for it.
And then she wins a Tony for Madea.
How are you able to see that, uncover that talent in people, and take them into their first role in a new setting?
I don't think I had any idea what I was doing. I think it happened. I don't think I was wise enough or smart enough, truly. I'm not being humble. I mean, I really believe. I didn't know what I was doing. It all like happened, and it happened to me, but not because of me. And then after that, Barry, even more so than myself, began to produce and learn how to produce and value what it was to be a producer. But then it happened to me.
Yeah.
I didn't plan it.
I want to talk a little bit about, I want to get to Chicago because Chicago is now, I believe, the longest running show.
Yeah. The longest running
American show.
23 yeah. years on Broadway.
26.
26 now. Okay.
26, come
yeah,
on.
Yeah.
The years go by quick. Yeah.
The longest running
American show.
Show wow. is Phantom.
Interesting. Okay.
Phantom's 4 years more than us.
Oh, you'll catch up.
Yeah.
You think?
Up. Yeah, I think so.
Well, they're over.
And you're in 25 countries.
So we have four more
That's
years.
That's right. Phantom's done and you're still going.
Oh, God, it's tough.
So I think you can. I think you will continue. I'm going to call you, by the way, when you become the number one globally.
Thank you, We'll have dinner.
I would love it. Yeah.
You pay.
I'll cook. I'm also a foodie.
Expensive.
I want to talk about, I mean, you did obviously Chicago, but also after Madea, things really started to progress.
You did Fiddler at the same time as you're doing Gypsy and another show. So you went from being a rookie producer to winning a Tony to then having your next show with an actress who wins a Tony to then producing three major Broadway plays, all of which were enormously successful at the same time.
And although, you know, we're talking about theater here, there's this incredible entrepreneurial thing here, which is, there was a quote that I read that you said, which I loved, which is, you can't just sell shows on Fridays and Saturdays.
Right.
That you need to figure out a way to have
Wednesday nights.
Wednesday nights packed.
How did you do that?
And how did you do that? Because that is, again, I know you may not call yourself a business titan
Barry is almost a genius, really talented at marketing. That's who he is. And you have to market it. You have to sell it. I'm not good at that. It's not who I am. Mm-hmm. But he loves it. And he comes up with extraordinary ideas and works with our press agent and our marketing people. And he made it happen.
Where did you make the most impact?
Like, I go to every audition. Barry goes to the final audition. Mm-hmm. I'm very good with the actors. I'm really good with the director. Anything to do with the artistic end of it. Barry is also good with that, but he is good with the business, and I am not.
Yeah. For you, it's the people.
It's not who. Oh, yeah. I mean, no matter what, the bottom line is filling seats.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how great the show, how bad the... Are people going to come?
Well, but you got some big names. I mean, you got Kathleen Turner, who at the time was a huge actress, who had never done a Broadway play. But in that moment, she made a haphazard comment that she wanted to do Cat on the Hot Tin Roof.
Yeah.
And you read this and called her up. And,
we got her.
Yeah.
Anthony Quinn as well.
Oh, my God.
Tell us those stories.
Yeah, we love those stories.
Well, Zorba, he did it in the movies.
Yeah.
So we gave him the opportunity to do it in theater.
This is Orbit the Greek.
This is Anthony Quinn.
Yeah.
And we did he was with us 4 years, a year and a half on Broadway, 2.5 years on the road. No matter what I said to him, he said, thank you so much, I'll discuss it with Barry. No matter what I said. And I knew he wasn't just an American, what do you call, that doesn't talk to women.
Chauvinist.
He wasn't an American male chauvinist. I knew he was born in Mexico, and I knew, not Ireland, but, and I knew that his mother walked 5 steps behind his father, and that the man made all the decisions, and that's how he grew up. So when I would come to him, he would say, thank you so much, I'll discuss it with Barry, and it was fine. But after a year and a half, I thought I'm gonna kill myself. I can't have a conversation with him. Nothing I say makes any sense to him, nor is he interested in my opinion. So I thought for a year and a half, and then finally I said, I can't stand it. So I invited him. I said, Barry and I wanna take you to lunch to the Russian Tea Room at that time.
The place
to go.
Yeah.
And so, and Faith Stewart ran it. You know.
It's still around today.
Yeah. And there were 2 places, if you go into the Russian Tea Room, one here, one there, that were the places to sit. If you were with a celebrity or you were a celebrity, they gave you those 2. And the whole place walked in and looked at those tables. So I'm sitting at that table without Barry alone. Because I'm holding the place for Anthony Quinn. So Anthony Quinn walks in, takes him 15 minutes to get to the table, because Anthony Quinn. And he's got a cravat, and he's got the whole thing, and the gray hair, and the
paparazzi.
Everything. Yeah. So he gets to the table, and he sees I'm alone. And he says, where's Barry? And I said, you know, he was coming, but something came up. And he wasn't able to come. I'm so sorry he wasn't able to come. Turns around to leave. The whole place is looking at us. I remember, I honest to God remember, Haley, reaching across the thing and grabbing his thing and said, please, I'm a woman alone. Don't do this to me. You're a gentleman. Which is a lie. He was never a gentleman. I said, please, please, please sit with me. He said, all right. So he comes around and he sits with me. Everything he said during that lunch was monosyllabic. Not 2 syllables. Mm-hmm. No. Yeah. Mm. Not even maybe. He wouldn't give me the benefit of him speaking to me. He wanted me to know. So we had this horrible lunch. When they were ready to serve coffee, which he didn't want, but I ordered tea, so he was forced to stay. I called over the maitre d' and I said, I have to talk alone to Mr. Quinn. Would you please not give us service for the next 10 minutes or so? He said, of course, of course. So I looked at him and I said, Mr. Quinn, Tony. He said, Mr. Quinn. I said, okay, Mr. Quinn. I guess you wondered why I brought you here under false circumstances. Thank you.
Of course.
And he says,
I try to be a gentleman. I'm like Anthony Quinn.
It works.
Good.
So he says, yeah, I want to know why. I want to know why you lied to me. I want to know why you're a liar. That's exactly what he said,
wow.
Why you're a liar. And I said, I just want you to know that I have the highest regard for you as an actor. I know that you have no true craft, but I know you have incredible charisma, and that charisma goes across the footlights, and the audience loved you. I also wanted him to know I knew he had no craft.
So you wanted to sort of dig him a little bit, maybe give him a little bit of a shot.
I don't know if he was smart enough to
get hear it. That. Wow.
He heard charisma.
Yeah, yeah. So you gave him a little bit of a jab, but you want him to know.
I said,
put him in his place a bit.
I said, so I just want you to know I have the greatest respect for you as an actor. Honestly, God, it's this much. If you could give me just this much respect as a producer, I would be so grateful because I really care about your costumes. I care about your props. I care that you're happy with the other directors. I care that you respect the actor. And I will support you in all those ways. If you would just give me a little more respect, even half as much as you give Barry. And he said, you know, kid, that's how we talk.
And you're in your 50s at
this point. Right. I'm maybe 60. Okay.
And you've won Tonys. You're not nobody.
He says, you know, kid, you're quite a kid. I get it. I really get it. You know something? I will call you. I will call you, and I'll do business with you and Barry. I said, thank you so much. The bill comes, and believe it or not, he reaches for the bill. And I said, why are you reaching for the bill? He said, because I'm the man. I said, you may be the man, but I'm your boss. So I paid the bill. So now the next morning, Anthony Quinn calls. We had a housekeeper. She says, Anthony Quinn's on the phone, and Barry said, I'll get it. He says, no, he isn't asking for you, Mr. Weisler. He's asking for Mrs. Weisler.
Nice.
He's calling me. So I go and get the phone. I said, hi, Tony, how are you? He said, you said I could call you. I said, yes. He said, listen, we're going on tour soon. I said, right. He says, I want the masseuse to travel first class. That's my first...
direct favor
for you. So he asked if he could have a masseuse. And he was an older man. He did 8 shows a week. Mm-hmm. He deserved it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we were happy to pay for it. So we got him a masseuse. I got a call from his agent about a week after. And his agent said, thank you very much for getting him a masseuse. I said, I'm delighted. He said, he needs a masseuse that specializes. And I said, that specializes? That was so stupid. When he used to get out of the show, Yolanda, his wife, was sitting right there. God forbid another woman walked in the dressing
room. She was protective.
Not protecting him. She was jealous.
Okay, got it.
She was there. Nobody else was going to be there. So... he wanted a masseuse, and he wanted a masseuse that would do something special. And I was so stupid, I said, what is she supposed to do?
And why does a masseuse need a first class ticket?
So I went, she said, ask Barry. So Barry said, Fran.
I said, it's a special masseuse.
Oh, okay.
So happy ending masseuse.
So we wanted the masseuse to travel first class. And I said, I said, Tony, I called him.
Now you're calling him Tony.
Yeah, I called him, and I'm calling him Tony.
Yeah.
I said, listen, you can have the masseuse. The masseuse can make you very happy and do a good massage. I said, but you are traveling first class. Your wife is traveling first class. Do you think the masseuse sitting next to you in your life in first class, your wife may question that?
Right.
He said, you're so smart. I never thought of that. I said, look, you're going to travel first class. Your wife is going to travel first class. She can travel business class. I said, she's traveling, coach. And don't talk to me about it anymore. He was with us 4 years.
Wow.
And he sold out every performance.
Wow.
And she traveled, coach.
The whole time.
The whole
time. So
and he had her with him the whole time.
The whole time. Yeah.
Because the wife wasn't going to go in
and
watch his massage.
So you built this reputation as being able to really work with the actors and actresses. Tell us about Kathleen Turner, because she was such a big name at that time.
She was a huge deal, and we sold out Cat in a Hot Tin Roof. And she wanted a certain person to play Big Daddy. And I had chosen and contracted, I think Barry had done it, Charles Durning. And so Charles Durning was, and she came to me and said, I don't want Charles Durning, I want someone else. The other person she wanted was terrific, but so was Charles Durning. And I had already, I said, there's nothing in your contract, Kathleen, that says
you get to choose.
That you get to choose.
Right.
Your agent didn't put it in your contract. If he had, we'd be in a whole different place. I said, so Charles Durning is playing Big Daddy. She said, I don't believe this. I said, again, I said, you don't like him. You're an actress. Act. And she said, then I'm going to choose Brick. I said, you know, if I have Charles Durning and Kathleen Turner, who cares who Brick is, as long as he's decent.
Amazing. There's two things that I want to ask you about. The first thing is how you deal with incredible talent, because David's right. I mean, one of the things that the theme that emerges when you ask people about you, Fran, and hear your story is you have this way of dealing with these huge celebrities that are, you know, A-list, to like triple A-list. So I want to talk about that. I also want to talk about the transition of you feeling that chauvinistic, I'm Barry's wife,
right,
to you being Fran on your own, like big shot. Let's start with sort of the celebrity stuff first. How did you figure out a way? What was the formula that you used to crack these incredible A-listers so that they listened to you and they did the best work of their lives, their careers?
I didn't have to deal with them on a professional level like you might think I did. The director did that. The director directed the show.
Yeah.
Once you produce the show, you give it to the director gives it to the actors give it to the audience. So I'm almost out of it, except with the producers.
Right.
But it keeps going down. So I didn't really have to, I could be above the fray,
yes,
as could Barry.
Yeah.
So we could be lovely while the director's giving them hell.
Right.
So I never had, I can't remember, I'm sure there were if I searched my brain more, but I think we got along, Barry and myself, with almost every actor we worked with. We respected them. They got here because they belonged here.
Yeah.
Obviously they had the talent and the wherewithal.
Yeah.
And we always showed them great respect. And underneath, just like all of us, they were insecure.
Yeah,
right.
And they were secure.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had the same fibers that all of us
do. You understood that. Yeah. Talk a bit about sort of this, you emerging from Barry's wife to being Fran on your own. This
right. You know, Anthony Quinn can't be the only show.
That's right. I mean, like, you know, people refer to you as the Queen of Broadway. Like, when did
that
happen?
That's a lie.
Okay, well, that's what everyone else says. So we certainly do, and everyone else does. But when did that, I mean, when did that happen? And how important was that for you to sort of be out of the shadow? I mean, you guys were a partner, an amazing partnership, the Barry and Fran show, but you are also just Fran on your own.
Right, you brought a lot to the table.
It just came, you know, like I go to every audition. Barry goes to the final audition, I said. So I was very involved with the creative end, and I'm repeating myself, but he was also, but not to the degree I was, but Barry produced the show. And there's a lot to producing other than the rehearsal hall. I mean,
fundraising in itself.
Oh, God, just getting money to, it's the hard, 80% of Broadway shows fail, 80%.
Wow.
They pay back 50%, 75%, or none of their money.
Wow.
I'm 80%, and I'm not exaggerating.
And those are the good ones.
I think it's because also most producers work alone, and they bring in partners we're already like this.
Sure.
And we're very fortunate. We deeply care about each other, yeah. which is, I know how rare that is.
Let's talk about that partnership, because that is probably one of the major yeah. you know, secrets, ingredients to your success
I
has
think
been
so.
The
That's
two of you working together. But yeah. actually, you know, one of the fascinating parts, David and I are both fortunate to be, you know, deeply in love with our wives and our kids, but our wives in particular. And one of the things we've noticed across this whole Big Shot project is behind every Big Shot is a massive support system, particularly from their spouse. And you and Barry have been married how many years?
56.
56 years. We sat down with someone recently that was married
67
years.
Yeah.
These
yeah.
are amazing stories of incredible relationships. What's been the secret or the key to you and Barry not only building an empire together, yeah. but frankly, being this incredible couple?
You know, I don't think you can make it happen. I honestly don't. I think it's very rare, and believe me, I appreciate it, if two people love each other and can be together year after year after year. And there's not one day that I don't appreciate what we have. And he'll kill me for saying this, but there's not one day in 56 years that he hasn't said, I love you to me.
Wow.
Not one day.
Wow.
And don't ever let him know.
No, he'll never know this.
Don't tell.
Yeah, we won't tell anyone. Everyone watching. Wow. Every single day he's told you.
Every either nighttime or morning, he just does. And we love each other and much more. We're in love with each other. And it's like so fabulous. And I have so many friends and they're in good marriages. They're not in great marriages. And
what's the difference to you? What's the difference in that way?
You know, I think it's, I don't think you can work at it. I mean, you have to, but you either have it or sometimes you don't. And I think 90% of the time, two people, I mean, you pick a person that's a stranger and society says you spend the rest of your life with that person and you have children with that person. And of course you can get divorced, but how many times are you supposed to?
Right.
So it's really not normal to pick one person in the whole world that you decide to spend your life with. And if you find that person and it works, oh my God, cherish it. Because it's so unrealistically difficult.
Yeah.
But we found it.
Huh.
And so one of the keys, I think, to any success we may have enjoyed is the fact that we are so close that when I say something, he listens, and when he says something, I do. When I turned 90 5 years ago, I started doing less. I got more tired, and I continued to get more tired. And now at 95, I'm not working half as hard, half. I go to Florida, to Palm Beach for 4 months. I could never, I mean, whoever envisioned that And believe me, I'm not working.
Yeah, you weren't the Palm Beach type.
Right.
I love it there.
Yeah. You only slowed down at 90. I mean,
I know. But I'm telling you, up until 90, I worked very hard. But that's for the last 5 years, I'm not working that hard.
Let's shift gears to Chicago, which, I mean, you were very successful. But Chicago changed your lives.
Changed our lives.
Right.
Professionally and economically.
Right. But nobody wanted it.
Nobody.
What did you guys see in Chicago that others didn't?
Well, it was at the Encore series, you know that? So they do all shows that failed. And although we've been producing it for 26 years, like 30 years prior to that, way, way back, Chicago opened and closed in something like 6 to 8 weeks.
Wow.
It was full costumes.
On Broadway?
On Broadway, okay. It was full costumes, full sets, they did it like a normal show. And for whatever reason, it didn't succeed. So they did it at Encores, and Encores only produces failed shows. And they honor maybe the playwright, the composer, the lyricist, maybe there's one great song. So we went the fourth night, because we thought, who cares, it's a failed show. We go the fourth night, and it's just, everybody's in their underwear, the orchestra's on stage, there's chairs lined up on either end, and all the actors are sitting in the chairs. It's so informal. And I remember saying, oh my God, I love this show. And Barry went home and said, we love this show. We went the fourth night. So we called Kander and Ebb, who were the composer and lyricist, and have the rights. And we said, we know we went the fourth night. We know every producer in New York wants to do the show. Give us just a little piece of it. We don't even care if our name is on it, which is a lie. We can't.
Of course.
So.
Hustler. I love it. Yeah.
So there's a long pause. And Fred Ebb says, you've got the whole show. We said, what do you mean we have the whole show? He said, nobody wants the show. Barry and I are on two phones, and we're looking at each other thinking, what's wrong with us?
Right.
What don't we get? So we said, look, we give you our word we will produce Chicago. We give you our word. And we already produced Cabaret that you did and Zorba that they did. So you know us well. Do you mind telling us? Do you know why nobody wants to produce the show? They said, funny you should ask, because it's the fourth day. We called this morning the Niederlanders and the Schuberts and said, do you mind telling us? We took away all this junk and now it's just a tight show that we think is great. Why don't you want to produce the show? And they both said the same thing, the Niederlanders and the Schuberts. They said, there's no French Revolution. Chandelier dropping. And there's no helicopter on stage. That's what we're looking for.
There's no dramatic
Les Mis, Phantom of the Opera.
Right.
And Miss Saigon.
Right.
With the helicopter.
So they wanted to copy a formula.
Wanted a big, big thing. And we have this show where the actors are practically in black, and the orchestra's right in front of you, and there's no sets.
But what did you see that was?
I don't know. You know how sometimes either of you walk in somewhere and you say, this is it for me?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like you go into a restaurant and say, where haven't I been here before? Yes. We just knew. I mean, it was just luck or stupidity or smartness. We just knew.
And then what did it take for you? So now you own the
show. So now the reason it changed our lives economically is all those people wouldn't give us money. First of all, people don't like to invest in Broadway. Too many failures.
Yeah, right, 80%.
It really is. 78, 80. So it was $2.5 million. When you think that Hamilton is $19 million, Wicked is $17 million, this is $2.5 million. But if you don't have it,
it could be a billion dollars.
It could be a billion. Right. So we went to 5 banks, 3 in New Jersey, I believe 3 in New Jersey, and 2 in the island or vice versa. We borrowed $500 from each bank, so we had $2.5 million. So all the money is ours.
Wow.
So now when the review came out, and all you do opening night is wait to read the damn New York Times. And at that time it was Ben Brantley. And something like, run, do not walk to the blah, blah theater to see the greatest show, blah, blah, blah. I mean, we almost fainted.
And that $2.5 million.
Yeah, where did that come from?
Was that all in? Like, what was at stake for you at that point?
And who gave you that money?
The banks.
5 different banks, but only $500 each.
But you signed for it, right?
I'm assuming. Oh, yeah. Oh, we would have.
Okay, so it wasn't one bank, it was small chunks.
You would have been done. You would have been done. Yeah, bankrupt.
Yeah. Bankrupt.
Well, so you went all in on Chicago.
Yeah.
This play that neither of the other two big producing families wanted.
You know, have you ever, I'm sure you have. Yeah. Sometimes you fall in love with something you're passionate about. You don't know why. Nobody might like it, but you just know it does something to your gut. And we're producers, so that's what we do for a living.
Right.
So we thought, we just loved it so much.
And usually that's what leads to the greatest success. I mean, that's sort
or
of big.
Not, that,
or not, but I mean, that's sort of big shot for David and I. Big shot we're doing for us. We just
really
think these type of conversations are everything. This fills us with great energy. And we didn't know if anyone would listen to it. Turns out a lot of people do want to listen to it, but you're right. Sometimes you go with your gut instinct on it.
It's not uncommon for lots of the big shots we've had on the show to have been enormously successful and then push all their chips in the middle and burn the boats and you know, really put it all on the line for one thing that they truly believe in.
I know.
And now you're 24 years later with Chicago. You said 24 years?
26.
26 years later with Chicago. Longest running American show, soon to be longest running global show.
Maybe.
I'm gonna bet on it. And no one wanted it.
Nobody.
I want to talk a little, just as we sort of close up here, because we're I don't want to keep you too long. This idea, though, that this idea of making it. One of the things that David and I struggle with quite a bit, and a lot of our guests talk about this, is have we done enough? Are we doing enough? This concept of enough. And I'm curious, for you, given all your success, your stage in your life, when did you know that you made it?
I guess over a period of time, dear, just producing show after show, and the money started coming in, and the reviews started coming in, and the actors fell in love with us, we fell in love with them. I don't think we ever had a moment where I think it was gradual. And even today, when you do a new show, we have a new show coming up, you're a wreck.
Now?
Oh.
Fran, after all this?
Yeah, right. But if you have something...
You're only as good as your last show, I guess.
You're only as good, and you too.
Yes.
Right.
Whatever you're doing, if you're doing something new,
Did those failures really sting hard?
Yeah, they you know, you fail.
You fail, yeah.
And your investors lose their money, you want to kill yourself, and you failed.
Yeah.
But we've had so much success. But our new show was called Real Women Have Curves, which is true. And Sergio Trujillo is directing it. He directed Jersey Boys.
Wow.
So he's really good, and he's a choreographer, director. So we'll be a wreck.
And you're still involved in every audition for that?
Oh, yeah.
Last question I'll ask you is this.
Good.
You said that your father wasn't able to see your success, but the rest of your family, is you have children. Do you want them to go into the family business? Is it a family business?
I pray they don't.
You pray they don't. Why?
It's really hard. And if you fail, you fail big. I mean, you have all this money and then you have none. And you lose your reputation a little bit. We've been lucky, whatever, and not good.
Yeah.
But I sort of like them to find their own way. And the one thing, you know how you want your kids to follow in your footsteps? We never did.
You don't.
It's so hard, and it's fraught with so much nervousness. The good thing I have is Barry and vice. So we have each other.
Yes.
And if something goes wrong, we can together. Someone of my kids alone doing it. So I kind of, and they've all found their own way in very different kinds of businesses.
Yeah.
And we're this close. We're very, very close-knit family.
Has the industry changed? Has theater, the business of theater, changed dramatically? Or is it generally the same formula, the same system that has always been the case? Great show, great story. You know, do you need a chandelier and a helicopter to make it work?
Yeah, I think you have an idea. Everything to me is the choice of director after the choice of show.
Right. First you pick the show, then you pick the director.
And then you pick the director. And if you're lucky and you pick right, and it's not Peter Cohen, you don't have to fire him.
Yeah. What happened to him?
You know, recently he died, unfortunately. I never wanted anything bad to happen to him. But he was difficult. He was from London. Mm-hmm. And I respect most of those English directors are brilliant. He mistreated an actor.
Yeah.
And
that's not okay for you.
He did it deliberately. He knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
It wasn't like he just
It was strategic. He was trying to create tension between them in sort of the real world to bring that on stage.
Yeah. But you felt that was the wrong approach and that it wasn't the culture you were going to build in your productions.
No. And remember, James is sitting like this.
Yeah.
Right.
He
was down. Yeah.
I mean, there's an empathy that I think that you have here.
Friend,
anything you want to pass down to future generations of ambitious Jews or non-Jews, people that maybe want to go to theater that don't, what do you want to pass down? If you're talking to 10,000 people in their 20s and 30s who want to be Fran, who want to be the next Fran, what would you say to them?
I guess be true to yourself, number one. That's such a cliche, but
it's important.
It's a cliche that works. You know, I have to really think about that. I guess you have to be prepared to really work hard. People sometimes think producing a theater on Broadway, a show. Oh my God, how fun. It's really hard. And picking the director and the scenic designer, the costumer, the lighting designer, the actors, the choreographer, all those people have to be, you have to really think about it. And then you have to think about what's the show?
Yeah.
And did you pick the wrong show?
Right.
Like so many people thought Chicago was.
Yeah.
They ran away from it. We happened to get lucky or smart or whatever it was. But
I think it was a lot more than that. I mean, you know, Fran, you've produced some of the best pieces of art that have inspired so many around the world.
Thank you.
Thank you. And it's been an honor to have you on Big Shot.
I'm so sorry you didn't see Barry. Barry.
Well, we'll come back to town.
We wanted Barry next.
Yeah.
We wanted you.
Okay.
Yeah. And actually, you know, as you probably know, our mutual friend Danny connected us.
Danny Meyer. Oh, I love
him. And he's a great guy. But when I asked Danny about you, he holds you with the greatest respect amongst the greatest people and doers and makers and builders and entrepreneurs on the planet. And you really inspire us. And thank you for joining us in Big Shot.
Oh, I loved it.
Thank you.
You're so easy.
You're a real trailblazer. Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started from the bottom.